good to see you. Yeah.
Reserve five for rebuttal.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Good morning, Council. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2023. We have three cases in our calendar today. Two are set for oral argument. One, the one that we have on the second, set for second oral argument today is A23-0151, Ronald Jeffrey Smith versus Brian Robert Kesson et al. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and then respondent 15 minutes for your arguments, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellants after that. There is a podium in the middle that has a button underneath, so you can lower and raise the podium itself, and you can also adjust the microphone for your height, and so that we can hear you properly. Please state your name for the record when you begin, and the party you are representing. And appellant, you may go ahead and proceed.
May it please the court, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm here on behalf of the petitioner appellant Ronald J. Smith. In our briefing, we raised three different issues regarding the January 23rd, 23 order, but for purposes of the oral argument, I'm going to focus on the threshold first issue, and that first issue is the district court's January 23rd, 2023 sua sponte dismissal of Smith's March 12, 2020 amended petition, wherein the district court gave no stated reasons or basis for that decision. As it relates to the first issue, the starting point is the standard of review. And because there are three legal arguments raised by the respondents to support that decision, because there is no factual record, factual findings in the decision itself. And I add that if with the transcript, you know, sometimes you can go back, I know in land use decisions, you can go back and you can listen to the transcript and you can piece together what was decided. In this case, that was not possible because the district court didn't make enough comments during the oral argument to do that. So we have no basis to understand what she was thinking. So de novo review applies under all the cases we've cited to. I will also cite you to the Minnesota Transitions case, the 2004 Minnesota Supreme Court case at page 3. And the reason I cite to it is I could not find a district court decision where, on appeal, where the district court, as here, made no basis, no rationale for the decision making. But Minnesota Transitions.
What's your best guess, counsel, as to what the district court was thinking? I mean, what is meant by the district court's comment? There has been a final judgment in this matter. It's dismissed, and it's dismissed without prejudice.
I don't know. There's three arguments.
The statute has a provision about dismissing petitions
right.
like this.
Right.
So why don't you put it in context with the statute?
Yeah. Thank you, Judge Bradfield. Is the first argument raised by respondent, to answer your question, is, and probably the most likely one, is the one that I told the court, I told the opposing counsel, you need to pursue it, which is one that, I think, Judge Reyes, you addressed this exact statute, but the provision is before it, and it's 257C.03 subdivision 8B, as in boy. And the reason I emphasize the B as in boy is, Judge Reyes, I think yours was, you addressed this issue for dismissal of a petition, I think it's a third, interested third party petition. But that's under 8A where there's a whole bunch of different factors. And we could not find, we found I think seven or eight cases where this court has addressed a dismissal of a petitioner or for custody or visitation under, or just custody under 8A, but none under 8B, Your Honor. So that's my best guess is that.
Language is pretty straightforward, and I don't see that you've suggested that the language is ambiguous. Am I wrong about that?
You are correct. You are correct.
So 2B is not ambiguous, right? And what does it tell us?
It tells us Specifically, if the court finds that a party cannot establish factors for visitation under 257C.08, which is what we're moving under, the court must dismiss petition for visitation. And the operative word, I believe, are two words. Is first, it says finds. And that's why I emphasize for the standard review, there has to be a finding. There's no finding here. Second of all,
the district court's decision, though, refers to final judgments in this matter. And as everybody in this room knows, this case has a long history. Yeah. So don't we already have those findings in this matter? Same file number?
No.
And why not? Because it looks to me, when I read, this case has already been at the Court of Appeals, when I read the prior decision of this court, it appears as though there has been a final decision on grandfather's petition.
There's correct. There's been a final decision on what we refer to as the second motion. There's no doubt about that. There was also, Judge Bradfield, there was a final decision as to the first motion, which was then sought, there was an amendment sought on that, which was granted in part, denied in part. And the reason why the Supreme Court's denial of our petition for review last, I think, November isn't dispositive of this action is that in family law matters, you have continuing jurisdiction. That's under the Lowe v. Lowe case from 1994, Minnesota Supreme Court. It's also under the Mashoff, M-A-S-C-H-O-F-F v. Leading, L-E-I-D-I-N-G, 2006 Court of Appeals decision. But most importantly, Your Honor, is the provision under 257C.08 subdivision 2B. And that language is determinative. And that language is as follows. It's one sentence. If a motion for grandparent visitation has been heard and decided, which we have had that twice.
But subdivision 2 concerns proceedings for dissolution, custody, legal separation, annulment, or parentage. And this is not such a proceeding, right?
No. Subdivision 2 is, I'm reading the entire subdivision 2B. And
well, isn't B tied to subdivision 2A?
It could have been, but it's not. And in fact, the rules of construction say it can't be, because if you read subdivision 257C08, subdivision 2A, and you go through custody, dissolution, et cetera, then B would be rendered meaningless, Judge Gaitis, because B is only about grandparent visitation. It is not identified under 2A. And so if you say, as respondents say, well, 2B has to be read as consistent with the heading under subdivision 2 and consistent with 2A, but if you do that, you violate one of the most important rules of construction, is you cannot render a provision meaningless, which is what this would be. And so the plain language, and the second rule, I think it's rule of construction.
I'm struggling with that. I'm not sure about whether Judge Gaitis has finished your question, but I'm struggling with that, because the construction that was offered by respondent's brief was that 2A deals with pending family court proceedings. They're all listed in 2A, and that subdivision 2B, the one that requires automatic dismissal upon certain findings, or must dismiss, that a court must dismiss a petition for visitation, suggests to me that only applies when the sole basis for the family court proceedings is grandfather's petition, which is what we have here, right? We don't have any ongoing family court proceedings as listed in A, dissolution, custody, legal separation, annulment, right? We have none of those.
That's right. And so if I heard you right, Judge Bradfield, and you're talking about 08 subdivision 2A and 2B, correct? Just so I, okay. I lapsed for a second there. Under 2B, if you read 2B, 2B is only about grandparent visitation. And if you look at grandparent visitation under 257C, you have it under subdivision 1, which is what we're pursuing under. There's also, I think it's subdivision 6 for if it's adoption, I think it is. There's a different provision. But if you look at adoption fits in the same category under, I believe it's 6, Your Honor, and as 1. And the only allowance for subsequent motions for grandparent visitation is under 2B, which then ties directly into 1 and 6, whatever the grandparent visitation for adoption. And I don't know of any rule of construction that says that we don't accept the plain language of 2B, which is for grandparent visitation, which we fit under, which subdivision 6 fits under, and say, no, no, no. They said grandparent visitation, but we're going to read into it 2A and the heading for 2. That doesn't make sense to me, but you don't even have to get there because the district court in the second order made a finding of fact, or not finding, a legal conclusion that this proceeding is subject to continuing jurisdiction, and he used that phrase. And he explained why.
So where does the district court use the phrase continuing jurisdiction? Do you have that citation for me? I definitely saw the argument in your brief. I couldn't see it in the district court's order.
If you don't mind, I'll get that for rebuttal. Would that be okay? Okay,
thank
yeah,
you.
There is a place. And so he uses the expression continuing jurisdiction, and he explains why that is, and it's essentially adopting the Liu v. Liu analysis as well as the mashing or mash off v. leading analysis. And so back to your initial question, Judge Bradfield, is first, what are they relying upon? What basis could the judge have made this decision? First is 257C03 subdivision 8B. She didn't make the finding, so that cannot be upheld. Second of all, she could have said, well, it's a final judgment. The Supreme Court denied review. The problem is that when I show you the continuing jurisdiction, the court's already said there's continuing jurisdiction here, and the question is changed circumstance.
Yes, and actually, you're getting to, doesn't this really boil down to whether or not continuing jurisdiction doesn't seem to be enough to get there, because we all understand family law matters often remain open and continuing, but aren't you in essence trying to argue that there has been a change of circumstances? And if that's the case, what are the change circumstances that have occurred since the last decision that had been made by the district court, affirmed on appeal by us, and denied petition for review by the Supreme Court, making a final judgment that the district court referred to in the order that you're challenging?
Judge Reyes, I'm going to answer it in two ways. First, not directly responsive, then I'll be directly responsive. But the first one is a legal analysis, is that the Mashoff case at page 839 says that if you have a situation where a petitioner, like us, is arguing for substantial change circumstances, but the district court does not adjudicate it, then you have to send it back. And here's what it says. On this record, this is page 839 of the Mashoff case, the existence of a substantial change in circumstances rendering respondents monetary support, blah, 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 was not adjudicated below. And the district court should not have applied res judicata to apply appellant from litigating that question. In the very next paragraph, the court goes on to say it has to be remanded because there's no adjudication to rule upon. And so that's the first, that's the legal response, Judge Reyes. Factual response is that we understood that we needed to show change circumstance. That's why I'm associated with Victoria Brenner, who this is the area of law she practices in. And so we not only have a sworn statement on October 14th from the petitioner, Smith, laying out 7 different change circumstances he believes exist. His wife, Diane Ives, same date, same sworn, or not the same sworn statement, but another sworn statement. And then probably most importantly for this court's comfort level that there are changed circumstances is we hired Dr. Joshua Coleman, no one questions he's an expert in this area, to interview the parents or the grandparents and to give an opinion, expert opinion, as to whether there are changed circumstances. And what he focused on primarily, Judge Reyes, is he looked at the record that was submitted. And we know from the opposition brief to the third motion, the record that was submitted by an opposition for interference is all about pre-counterpetition behavior. That's, and that is all predates April 3rd, 2020. We are now, and when we had this hearing, which is the operative date is, what's the changed circumstance, is January 23rd, 2023. What has changed? And so when you look at the September 30, 2021 decision of Judge Burns, which is, we call the second order, he says it's based on the facts. Well, what were the facts? The facts were, because they were all based on affidavits that were submitted for the first order, other than one tag-along affidavit, it was all based on pre-April 3rd, 2020 conduct. And so what we dealt with in our sworn statements from Smith and Ives and in the expert opinion for changed circumstance is we dealt with, well, what has changed? We talked about, Judge Ray, specifically at the bonding, is that one of the things you're afraid of with grandparents' visitation is, are you going to interfere, particularly when the grandparent role is so significant for the first 4 years of life? Did they have a chance to bond? Second one is also, okay, because interference is the issue, what has happened? Has Smith changed? Well, the best example of Smith changing is we have all of the examples of April 22, 2022, his offer. He is no longer trying to the extent he ever did, control the parents. He is asking a third party to determine what is fair. He's not trying to dictate anything. So my time is up, but that's the legal and the factual response to your question.
Thank you, Counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. And please be mindful of there is a clock on the podium as well.
Thank you. May please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jason Brown. I represent the respondents in this case, Brian and Catherine Kessen. Your honors, we are asking the court to affirm the most recent order of the district court. I'd like to deviate a bit from my pre-planned argument to just address a few of the pieces that Mr. Perry talked about a few minutes ago. And I think that the court is sort of leaning into the statutory framework that is at issue in this case. And that is what grants a grandparent standing to be able to seek grandparent visitation and what rules apply to that type of a request. Now, I would submit from a big picture point of view, Subdivision 1 standing rests in the fact that a parent of a grandchild has deceased. And Subdivision 2, as the court pointed out, rests in someone who seeks grandparent visitation when the mother and father of a child are involved in a court action amongst themselves, a custody dispute, a divorce, a legal separation. And so the reason that matters is that typically when one seeks relief under Subdivision 2, they file a motion, and they file that motion in the underlying dissolution, custody, or separation action. And that's why the statute under Subdivision 2 speaks to an ability to file another motion 6 months after adjudication of the first motion, because that's the vehicle under which or with which a grandparent may proceed under Subdivision 2. Subdivision 1 relief requires a grandparent to file a petition. And that word is important because a petition is an initial, request for relief, and it has its own case caption number, its own identity within the court system. And once that petition, therefore, has played out from district court to the appellate courts to finally a denial of review by the Supreme Court, that petition under the first statute that Mr. Perry cited, 257C03 subdivision 8B, that petition, as outlined in that statute, says it must be dismissed. So I just want to be clear that procedurally, there is no way to seek relief, to seek standing under Subdivision 2 of the grandparent visitation statute.
So, counsel, I appreciate you beginning with a process overview and your thoughts on how that works between Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2 of 08. What do we do under Subdivision 1 when there are changed circumstances? I think that's the question appellant's counsel is asking.
Well, I think that to that question, I think there are two prongs. There's a practical prong as to, you know, how can a grandparent come back and seek relief? And the second question that I think is legitimate is, does that grandparent, in fact, have standing to come back and seek relief? Because there is no carte blanche continuing jurisdiction in family court. To say that there is would actually render subdivision 8B of 257C03 meaningless.
So is it your position that it's sort of a one and done? Like if you don't get it with your petition, if you're not able to satisfy the requirements of 25C.08 subdivision 1, you are forever precluded from seeking visitation with the grandchild?
No, and I appreciate the question. No, I don't think you're forever precluded. I think from a procedural standpoint, the first case is closed, you would need to file a second petition. Now, the reason that filing that second petition is important is this. This case in particular has been on a perpetual circle for about 4 years, okay? The moment that grandfather gets a decision that he doesn't agree with, he returns immediately to the next available portion of the judicial branch to seek relief. And at some point, this litigation has got to come to an end, or at the very least, take a pause. I think that on a practical level, what's going on here from 30,000 feet is a misuse of the court system and harassment of my clients, because it's not weeks after one decision comes out that some other new theory is brought up, that some other new approach is taken in the case and some new form of an order is sought. This is now the seventh attempt in 3 years to come before some tribunal to seek relief. It was just about the anniversary of the last appellate decision in this case, in which this court said that the district court should be affirmed in finding that this grandparent, this grandfather, is someone who is an interfering grandparent. A court-ordered grandparent visitation schedule will interfere with the parent-child relationship.
But counsel, determination was based on a particular record. So I'd like you to get back to Judge Kaitis' question and my question. You know, you seem to acknowledge that there is a scenario under which, with changed circumstances, a grandparent can return and file a subsequent petition.
Yeah.
It didn't happen here. I understand that.
It did not.
But should we stand on a formality such as, you know, that the prior matter should have been dismissed, it wasn't. Instead, there was a motion filed. Should we stand on that formality today, which seems to be what the district court decided to do, or should we simply let, you know, grandfather proceed with his changed circumstances argument? I think you agree there's been no merits determination on changed circumstances, right? We don't have a lower court decision on that.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
I think it's important for this court to affirm because it would require grandfather to file a new petition. And because of that, it would open up the door to additional arguments concerning collateral estoppel and res judicata. Now, grandfather has run from those arguments consistently. The court has said in its prior orders it's not necessarily interested in entertaining collateral estoppel or res judicata because it's a pending action. There can be a change of circumstances. But I think that by filing a second action, a court action, a new action, we can flesh out what is a fact dispute and what is not. What's happening here is grandfather is trying to utilize the facts from a long time back and continue to bring them up and continue to re-adjudicate them. There are certain facts that have been adjudicated already in this case. The most prominent finding, of course, is that he's an interfering grandparent based on years of behavior. Now, it's important to call that out because we're here today with accusations made about what was the intent of the Kessens when they signed their petition, and a direct threat, it's in their brief, that there's some criminal action, some criminal conduct going on with the Kessens, that somehow they are defrauding the court. They've implicated me in this scheme, this grand scheme, to somehow fraud the court, and they're going to get to the bottom of it. Those facts, the implications surrounding the meaning of the initial petition in this case, that was adjudicated two and a half years ago when grandfather brought that issue up in his motion for amended finding. And the district court said two things. Number one, it doesn't matter what the counter petition said because grandfather is the one with the burden of proof and he didn't meet his burden. And second, any consequence that stems from a mediated temporary agreement from 2019 was considered by the district court in rendering its decisions. So those issues are gone. And now they're trying to bring them up again on appeal a second time. The first time they didn't raise it in their second motion. Now they try to frame it as an issue that they raised in the district court. But the fact is that was adjudicated years ago without an appeal. So by requiring grandfather to file a new petition, we carve away distinct lines of what is truly in dispute. Grandfather in this case served a mountain of discovery. All of a sudden, 33 months later, he wants to take the deposition of his ex-wife in the middle of Wisconsin, and he wants me to go and sit there and listen to the testimony. That testimony was part of the factual record relative to the first motion that was filed. Adjudicated, motion for amended findings, done. Second motion filed, relied on the same record in building it, adjudicated, appealed, affirmed, denied review, and back. So the point is this. What they are trying to do, in my view, is strategically pile upon pile upon pile of time and obligation and engagements on the part of my client and anyone else who's had anything negative to say about Mr. Smith in this case and show them who's boss. And the court ought not accept that approach. If there are legitimate changes in circumstances, certainly those are fair game. But what are the eight, not seven, the eight changed circumstances that were brought up? The passage of time.
So, counsel, I'm going to stop you, not because I don't want to hear what you want to say about changes in circumstances, but my earlier comment. We don't have a district court decision on whether the submission that was made by grandfather in this case does amount to a change in circumstances. So if it seems to me, and I could be wrong, but you're suggesting that by affirming the dismissal of grandfather's petition, your understanding of Minnesota law would allow grandfather to file a new petition. In that new petition, grandfather would have to file, present changed circumstances that post-date the first petition.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I am following your argument.
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
So
we don't have any case law that says that, right?
We don't. Unfortunately, for both sides, unfortunately, there is not a great depth in the case law concerning grandparent visitation. I mean, we've got the overarching principles of SOHO and those sorts of cases that delineate the constitutional provisions and delineate the great weight that is given to parents in their opinion about these matters. But we really don't have the depth and breadth of appellate law that would apply. In fact, we don't have an appellate decision that says grandparents can seek, if they seek, a new grandparent visitation, that a change in circumstance is actually the standard that applies. We have that in dissolution cases and custody cases, but not here. So unfortunately, we don't have that. But yes, that is my position. And that would draw very narrow lines, and it would limit exactly what is at issue. And it would put an end to this vicious circle that's been going on about these same facts, the mediated agreements from 2019 that were temporary, that we just don't need to talk about anymore.
I want to make sure I understand. Are you saying that because there's no case law, change of circumstances does not apply to this or does?
I can't say that it applies or doesn't apply because I don't have a case that's told me that. I would tend to agree with counsel's position that by analogy we should apply that change in circumstance. I mean, I think that's a fair way to look at it. If the issue were tested, I would suspect that's the result.
So what are we to do in this case then if you do agree that the change of circumstances standard should apply, shouldn't we remand then to the district court to allow the district court make a decision as to whether or not there has been, in fact, a change of circumstances since the last decision by this court that had been affirmed by the Supreme Court?
I don't think that you should, and I understand the judicial economy in doing that. However, the concern I continue to have is this merry-go-round of litigation on facts that were decided years ago. I think if a new petition needed to be filed, we can narrowly tailor exactly what facts are at issue and therefore what is discoverable. Because the more practical side of this is that there's a mountain of discovery about things from 2017, 2018, they're trying to investigate, get their hands on, dig for, and it's just not appropriate to do that when all of those facts have already been adjudicated. If we've had a challenge getting the district court previously to say, well, yes, res judicata or collateral estoppel applies to those issues, we're not going to have discovery on them, I think that the cleanest way to move forward, the most cost-effective way to move forward, is have them file a new petition, and then we can debate the merits of the effect of res judicata, collateral estoppel, and narrow the scope of the action.
So if I may, counsel, and I might have misstated what you were arguing, so if we affirm the district court's dismissal, and under your view of Minnesota law, that would put grandfather in a position to file a subsequent petition, the legal framework for that would be that the grandfather would have to show changes of circumstances as defined by what was litigated in the first petition. So not really timed to the date of the first petition, but what was litigated as a result of the first petition. Am I following it?
Yes. I think any fact that has been adjudicated, any fact, whether it's about something that grandfather did to my client in 2016, whether it's about some interaction he's had with these grandkids in 2018, whether someone did or didn't follow a temporary mediated agreement, I think all of those facts are no longer subject to adjudication. And so it's a new day, and there are basically new facts that would need to be pled, which I think would constitute a need to prove up facts that would suggest a change in circumstance. I don't know what those would be, but we've got a sense based on the 8 that they've put forward, none of which, by the way, I think pass muster. Most of them address Mr. Smith's point of view and perspective, and many of them talk about serving discovery and things that happened prior to the service of his initial petition. So we're dealing with a pretty skeletal claim, I guess, on his part. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Quick housekeeping is it is subdivision 7 that deals with grandparent visitation with an adopted child, and under the respondent's reading of subdivision 2B, under this is 257C08 subdivision 2B, 2B wouldn't apply to subdivision 1, it wouldn't apply to subdivision 6, it would only apply nowhere. Because there is not a family court proceeding listed under 2A for which it would apply. That doesn't make sense. Second thing is, Judge Bratfield, you asked the question.
Well, it would be consistent in one regard, and that's in the use of the word petition. As counsel pointed out, subdivision 2 refers to a motion in 2B, but in subdivision 6, we don't see a reference to a motion. We see, again, a reference to a petition. And, going further with respondents' reasoning, it's petition that is the operative word in the Subdivision 8 dismissal provision of 257C03.
The problem I have with that, Your Honor, I just see the difference, is that we filed on March 3rd, and then amended on March 18th, 2020, a petition. The respondents filed a petition. That is what people have done in interpreting and applying subdivision 1. Everyone has done it that way. And to say, okay, we're going to deal with subdivision 1 differently, and we're not going to allow, consistent with continuing jurisdiction, when counsel even concedes, yeah, that's probably what, if you look at all the cases, that's what's at issue. And I want to respond to Judge Bradfield's question. It's on addendum page 23, paragraph 14. And it says, and you are correct, it didn't use continuing jurisdiction. That's the case law that I was referring to. I apologize. It says, as is the nature of family law, the issue of custody, parent time, and even support is routinely visited when a party can show a significant change of circumstances. And, quote, the same can be said for third-party visitation where a party, as in this case, has been previously found to have standing. And then the court went on to explain even more in paragraph 17 or 15 of that same order. In other words, the court recognized what I refer to as continuing jurisdiction. That's what the Supreme Court and this court has relied upon.
Well, you've heard opposing counsel. He tends to agree with you that change in circumstances would allow a subsequent petition. What he disagrees with you on is that you can proceed by motion, that the action continues once there's a final decision on the first petition. So how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, that's not what Judge Burns ruled with the second order. He said no, and he actually ruled on the second order without objection from respondents, ironically. Second of all is that there's only one way, and this is back to my comments to you, Judge Reyes, because you've had a subdivision 257C03 subdivision 8A case. 8B is the only way you can do it, and 8A is not, did we fail in round one and two to prove it? Instead, 8B uses the word cannot, which is the same, if you look at the dictionary, it's the same as what you'd have on a Rule 12. And so it's not, did we fail in rounds one and two? Absolutely we did. It's, can we prove that? And there is nothing in the record to say we cannot prove it, particularly in response to their failure to respond to our third motion, which means that they're conceding that all of their facts, mountain of facts, all predate their petition.
But you're talking about a motion, and several motions have been filed here, and when we're talking about subdivision A, dismissal of a petition, it does refer to the court must dismiss a petition, and that is how this action started, and that is what occurred. And if we look at the plain language, why didn't the district court get it right by saying, no, it says must. The court must dismiss a petition for custody if the court finds that the petition, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. The second half, the clause that you're reading from is correct. It refers to the petition. But the precedent is if the court finds that a party cannot establish factors, it's not did we not. We did not establish that in round one and two. The operative word is cannot. And so that's the key. And that word means something. That is the same as a Rule 12 dismissal is it's not a matter of did we fail in round one and two. Yes, we did. But there is no finding that we cannot do that. In fact, based upon...
I'm not quite sure. Are you talking about in subdivision 8B?
Yeah,
8B. The court finds that a party cannot establish factor for visitation made under section 257C008. The court must dismiss a petition for...
That's right. And so what I'm referring to is like standing. Like that's why I think the reason why Judge Burns put standing in his paragraph 14 is that you would have that appear if.
But when you're saying that the party cannot establish factors, there are two factors. Are you talking about the two factors?
Yeah.
One, the
best interest
interference of the children, and the second, interfering with a parent-child relationship.
Yeah.
But the district court did explicitly find several times that grandfather's actions would interfere with the parent-child relationship.
That's
so
true.
So that was not established. So it seems like that the cannot part has already been met.
If I can answer it, I'm sorry. Okay. Cannot, when you look at the dictionary definition, which this court has said that's what you rely upon, is not the same as did not. We did not. You are correct. Rounds one and two, we did not establish those factors. Absolutely 100%. But the word is cannot. And if they had found that, and maybe the district court will at some point say that Mr. Smith cannot establish factor one or factor two. They haven't done that. But I could not do it.
So your argument is that cannot does not mean the same thing as did not or does not.
Correct.
Okay. So
correct.
That, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Simple as that. I'm sorry, but
okay.
By being obtuse unintentionally. So.
No. I appreciate the clarification on that point.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral arguments here. We will be issue an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is the last case we have set for oral argument. We have one other case set for our non-oral calendar. And with that, court is adjourned. Thank you both. Thank you all.